Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming the President of the Republic of China, Taiwan, Ma Ying-jeou. President Ma, I'd like to present to you briefly our four panelists who I've already introduced at greater length. Our panel chair is Dr. William Perry, Professor Emeritus at Stanford and former Secretary of Defense. Our panelists are Dr. Thomas Finger, the Oxenberg Rowland Distinguished Fellow at the Spogli Institute, Ambassador Carl Eikenberry, William J. Perry Fellow in International Security here at CSAC and FSI, and Dr. Lan Hee Chen, David and Diane Steffi Research Fellow at the Hoover Institution. And now it's my pleasure to turn over this event to my dear friend and someone I have immense personal admiration for, Dr. William Perry, who will introduce President Ma.
Thank you, Larry. President Ma Ying-jeou was elected president in January of 2008 with 58% of the vote. Now, in the United States, if a president is elected by 58%, it's called a landslide. In fact, for 58%, almost any presidential candidate would give up his firstborn to get 58%. And at the time, the relations with the mainland were very tense. And President Ma campaigned on a promise to improve those relations. And that's a campaign promise which he kept. I had a personal observation of that. Just 2 months after he was elected, I led a delegation to visit first Taipei and then Beijing. And while there, I proposed the best way of dealing, of ameliorating the problem of tension. He wanted to improve air traffic, increase air traffic. And indeed, President Ma acted forcefully and vigorously on that. And within a few months, air travel began between Taiwan and the mainland, and now it's up to actually thousands of flights. It has had made an immense difference. It has made a difference in the economy. We do much business travel between the mainland and Taiwan. Tourism, which, among other things, creates good feelings and many family visits. So it's been, in my mind, an immense improvement in great lending more than anything has led to far better relationships, so that today we do not consider, and I don't think Taiwan considers either, the possibility of a military conflict with China to be high on the list of things to worry about. That's a big difference from 2008, and President Ma gets a lot of credit for that. The basic idea of increasing this travel was to replace MAD, Mutual Assured Destruction, with MAED, Mutual Assured Economic Destruction. And that each side was so deeply involved in economics on the other side that a military conflict would have been almost unthinkable. Now, President Ma was reelected in 2012 and has 1 year to go in his term of office. And so it's worth looking back at the legacy he will leave. He'll certainly leave a legacy and improve the economy. He diversified the economy. He created new growth engines. And most importantly, perhaps, he established the economic cooperation framework agreement between Taiwan and the mainland. So the economic legacy is deep and profound. Secondly, there's a security. The difference in security between now and 7 years ago is very great. Some of that, of course, stemmed from the improved economy. And then finally, he's given serious attention to improving the environment, both by reducing energy consumption and by leading to a substantial carbon reduction. It says in the model, which I believe you might well follow. So, President Ma, you have a year to go, but you already have left a very profound legacy behind you. And I'd like to sort of put over you now, your two remarks.
Thank you, Secretary Perry. Let me also introduce friends on our side. First of all, the Secretary General to the President, Mr. Zheng Yongquan. Secretary General of the National Security Council, Gao Huazhu. Minister of Foreign Affairs, Lin Yongle, Chen. Thank you. Now let me start my address. Secretary Perry, Professor Diamond, Dr. Fingard, Ambassador Eikenberry, Dr. Chen, distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen, good evening. I'm very happy to be here for today's video conference jointly sponsored by the Presidential Office of the Republic of China and Stanford University to commemorate the 70th anniversary of the ROC's victory in the resistance war against Japan. This gives us an opportunity to discuss the historical significance of World War II and ROC's resistance war with some of America's most distinguished scholars. We will also take a look at current developments in U.S.-ROC relations and cross-strait relations. Back in April of 2013, the ROC and Stanford held a video conference with many well-known scholars. It was moderated by former U.S. Secretary of State, Condoleezza Rice. That video conference was a resounding success, so we are very pleased to cooperate with Stanford University again and trust that we will recreate that success here today. This year marks the 70th anniversary of the end of World War II, as well as the ROC's victory in the resistance war against Japan. In July 1937, 2 years before World War II broke out, ROC forces began fighting against Japanese aggression alone. And for 4 long years, they continued with virtually no outside help. It wasn't until the Pearl Harbor attack in December 1941 that the ROC joined forces with the Allies to declare war against Japan, Germany, and Italy. The ROC's resistance war continued for 8 years, making it the longest war against foreign aggression in our history. It involved more citizens than any other conflict and required the most horrifying sacrifices. Over 3 million military personnel and 20 million citizens lost their lives or seriously injured. 268 generals died in combat. It also had a more lasting impact than any other war in our history. In his 2014 book, Forgotten Ally, China's World War II, 1937 to 1945, Oxford University professor Rana Mitter tells the story of the ROC's heroic resistance against Japan. Using outdated weapons against massive odds, ROC forces engaged in a war resistant to the end that brooked no surrender and no compromise. Without outside assistance, ROC forces tied down 800,000 fully modernized, well-trained Japanese troops, which allowed Allied forces to make counterattacks in both the European and Asian theater at the same time, and ultimately prevail. Professor Mitter believes that this was China's great contribution to the Allied powers in World War II. The United States proved to be a staunch friend. The most notable example of that friendship was the American Volunteer Group, AVG, organized in 1941, even before the Pearl Harbor attack. A group that became legendary by their nickname, the Flying Tigers. Before they had been in China for a whole year, the Flying Tigers had shot down nearly 300 Japanese aircraft, led by Commander Claire Chennault. They thus allow the ROC's severely crippled Air Force to gradually regain its fighting capabilities. So history tells very clearly and concretely, when the ROC really needed it, the U.S. was always there to extend a helping hand. The Lend-Lease Act of 1941 and the war materials supply under the Act are another good example of American friendliness and generosity. That kind of timely assistance and genuine friendship are quite touching and inspiring. This year, the ROC government will be holding a series of events to commemorate the 70th anniversary of the resisted war against Japan. And we will be inviting the family of President Roosevelt's grandson, granddaughter of General Claire Chennault, the leader of the Flying Tigers, and descendant of General Jimmy Doolittle, leader of the Doolittle air raid on Tokyo in April 1942, 5 months after Pearl Harbor. The grandson of General Whitmire, chief of staff of the China Theater during 1944-46, and granddaughter of missionary Minnie Mouchen, who was acting dean of the Jinling Girls College and nicknamed American Goddess at the Rape of 1937. Who helped save the lives of 10,000 Chinese citizens, mostly women, to participate in those events. We will then have a chance to thank them in person for the tremendous contribution that their forebears made to the Republic of China and its people, no matter how long that historic event has passed. During the Cold War period, following World War II, the friendship between the ROC and the U.S. flourished. As the U.S. continued to help us militarily while providing economic assistance, between 1950 and 1965, that assistance included $1.5 billion in economic aid, which is probably worth at least $12 billion now. The U.S. president for much of that era, Dwight Eisenhower, also made a series of key decisions that had a telling effect on peace in the Taiwan Strait. He signed the Sino-American Mutual Defense Treaty of 1954, which made the ROC and U.S. military allies again. It was also President Eisenhower who continued to dispatch the 7th Fleet to patrol the Taiwan Strait, pursuant to the Formosa Resolution passed by Congress in 1955. During the 1958 Taiwan Strait crisis, President Eisenhower dispatched U.S. naval personnel to provide logistics and convoy for ROC forces stationed in Jinmen and Mazu, the two offshore islands less than 3 kilometers from the Chinese mainland. President Eisenhower personally visited the ROC in June 1960, shortly before his second term expired, and issued a joint communique with President Chiang Kai-shek. That communique affirmed that under the Sino-American Mutual Defense Treaty, both parties oppose any provocation involving Taiwan, Penghu, Kinmen, and Mazu. And that affirmation became the foundation for the ROC's stable development and peace in the Taiwan Strait for the next 2 decades. Although the ROC and U.S. severed diplomatic ties in 1979, barely 3 months later, the U.S. Congress passed the Taiwan Relations Act, the TRA. Under that act, Taiwan is treated as a foreign government for purposes of U.S. law and in U.S. courts. The act also requires the U.S. to provide Taiwan with defensive weapons. I remember at that time, one U.S. scholar, Carl Gable, commented on American change in diplomatic direction. He said that when President Carter established formal diplomatic relations with mainland China and cut ties with Taiwan, that amounted to de-recognition of Taiwan by the executive branch. But then the Taiwan Relations Act was enacted by Congress, which kept intact all but formal diplomatic ties with the ROC, amounted to legislative re-recognition of Taiwan. At that time, I was studying law at Harvard. One day, I came across Professor Stefan Bach, supervisor of my doctoral thesis, in the hallway of the library. He said to me, "Angel, I understand how you felt these days, but I want you to know that Taiwan is the most recognized, unrecognized government of the United States." What happened in the following 36 years is exactly like what Professor Bach said. Since I came into office in 2008, mutual ROC-US trust has been restored at the highest level of government. And over the past 2 years, they have been frequent reciprocal visits by high-level officials. In April of last year, U.S. Environmental Protection Agency Administrator Gina McCarthy visited Taiwan and Charles Rifkin, Assistant Secretary of State for Economic and Business Affairs, is visiting Taiwan now. At the same time, heads of various ROC government agencies have visited the U.S., so there is a solid foundation of mutual trust there. For many years, the U.S. government has faithfully fulfilled the provisions of the Taiwan Relations Act, as well as the 6 assurances associated with the communique on August 17, 1982. And in the 7 years since I took office, U.S. arms sales to Taiwan have reached $18.3 billion. That is the highest total in the past 20 years, and twice what was sold during the previous administration. And the ROC is also gaining more support in Congress. Just last month, during deliberations on the National Defense Authorization Act for fiscal year 2016, the House and Senate Armed Services Committee both passed initiatives that call for increased U.S. ROC military exchanges. Those initiatives include inviting the ROC to participate in the rim of the Pacific exercise, RIMPAC, and red flag training exercises, clearly upgrading bilateral Taiwan-U.S. security cooperation. In addition to strong security ties, Taiwan-U.S. trade relations have also made significant progress. Over the last few years, in March of 2013, after a 5-year hiatus, we reopened negotiations with the U.S. under the Trade and Investment Framework Agreement, TIFA, a platform set up in 1994 to facilitate talks in trade and investment matters. We have continued bilateral consultations in a series of 12 work conferences and have made significant progress. As of the end of this March, the ROC is America's 10th largest trading partner, surpassing Brazil and Saudi Arabia, and the U.S. is Taiwan's 3rd largest after mainland China and Japan. Meanwhile, the U.S. decision to let Taiwan join the visa waiver program in November 2012 proves to be a right and popular move. Out of the 38 countries that have such status, Taiwan is the only one that does not have formal diplomatic ties with the U.S. The number of Taiwan visitors to the U.S. rose about 20%. They not only admire your history and your way of life, they are also serious shoppers. They contribute a lot to narrow the trade deficit you have with Taiwan. So all these things add up, increased trust at the highest levels and closer political, economic, and security cooperation show that over the last 7 years, Taiwan-U.S. ties are the best they have been in the 36 years since the Taiwan Relations Act was passed. Successive U.S. Secretaries of State, Hillary Clinton and John Kerry, have both publicly affirmed that Taiwan is an important security and economic partner of the United States. And that is pretty good summation of the current state of bilateral Taiwan-U.S. relations. Let me now turn to cross-strait relations. Since I was elected in 2008, I have been firmly committed under the framework of the ROC Constitution to maintaining the status quo in the Taiwan Strait. In this context, the term status quo means no unification, no independence, and no use of force. I have also remained committed based on the 1992 consensus, which is one China, respective interpretations, to promoting cross-strait peace and development. These policies have completely transformed the Taiwan Strait so what was once a flashpoint for conflict, now a haven of peace. Over the past 7 years, Taiwan and mainland China have signed 21 agreements. During the same period, visitors from mainland China have made over 14 million trips to Taiwan, almost 4 million of them in the past year alone. So the cross-strait situation is more stable and peaceful than it has ever been in the past 66 years. Progress toward peace and stability in cross-strait relations over the past 7 years has had a significant peace dividend. The vicious cycle of cross-strait and foreign relations of the past has become a virtuous cycle. So countries from all over the world have been able to freely interact with both sides of the Taiwan Strait at the same time under the One China respective interpretation concept and unprecedented development. In April last year, U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for East Asian and Pacific Affairs, Daniel Russell, said in Congress that, as a general matter, we very much welcome and applaud the extraordinary progress that has occurred in cross-strait relations and the Ma administration. In February this year, he also said that developments in Taiwan-U.S. relations over the past few years have been very constructive, and that progress in cross-strait relations had a lot to do with that. U.S. Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for East Asia and Pacific Affairs, Susan Thornton, also stressed recently that unofficial Taiwan-U.S. relations have never been better. She noted that over the past few years, the stable handling of cross-strait relations has been an important factor in the close cooperation that now characterizes Taiwan-U.S. relations. She went on to say that the benefits that stable cross-relations ties have brought to both sides of the Taiwan Strait, the United States and the region, have been enormous. It is important that both sides of the Taiwan Strait understand the importance of this benefit and work to establish a basis for continued peace and stability. Maintaining close communication and a no surprise, a low-key approach has allowed all parties to demonstrate restraint and flexibility. We want to see this approach continue. So, this marks the first time since the beginning of the Cold War that the U.S. need not choose sides in cross-strait equation. And mainland China and Taiwan need not face this predicament either. This is how the very foundation of the status quo in Taiwan-U.S. relations. In addition to seeking stable development in cross-strait and ROC-U.S. relations, Taiwan has also taken concrete actions over the past few years to be a regional peacemaker in both the East China Sea and the South China Sea. Back in August of 2012, I proposed the East China Sea Peace Initiative. That initiative asked stakeholders to forego conflict in favor of peaceful negotiations and emphasize cooperation in sharing resources. 8 months later, in April of 2013, Taiwan and Japan signed a fisheries agreement that embodies the spirit of that initiative and solved a fisheries dispute between Taiwan and Japan that has troubled both countries for 40 years. That agreement elicited widespread praise and support from the global community. Secretary of State John Kerry has publicly stated that the ROC-Japan fisheries agreement is a model for promoting regional stability, and that the principles at the heart of the East China Sea Peace Initiative apply to all the waters in Asia. In the East China Sea, the East China Sea Peace Initiative encourages stakeholders to share their dispute and cooperate to create win-win situations. Its success makes it a model for peaceful development in the South China Sea. So on the 26th of last month, I formally announced the South China Sea Peace Initiative, hoping that the relevant parties will share sovereignty disputes, pursue peace and reciprocity, and promote joint exploration and development. By upholding those principles, we hope that all the parties involved will work together to maintain regional peace and promote regional development. Immediately, a U.S. State Department official stated that the U.S. appreciated the proposal in South China Sea Peace Initiative. I sincerely hope that all the outstanding scholars and experts gathered here will support the pursuit of peace that I've presented today. So today, as we commemorate the 70th anniversary of the ROC's victory in the resistance war against Japan and end of World War II, I hope we can put aside the trials and tribulations of the past and look forward to a brighter future. The people and government of the ROC cherish our hard-won peace and prosperity, and hope that all countries can turn the painful lessons of history into a force of regional peace and prosperity. Inspired by our own successes in promoting cross-strait and regional peace, we also appeal to countries all over the world to resolve disputes through peaceful means and work together as we seek sustainable peace and prosperity for all of humankind. In short, we commemorate the victory of World War II to prevent future wars. Another observation I want to make is that both Washington and Taipei agree that the current Taiwan-U.S. relations is at its best in 36 years. What are the key reasons for that? In my view, there are two key reasons beyond strong traditional friendship built since World War II. First of all, the successful handling of cross-strait relations based on the 1992 consensus, namely One China, respective interpretations. Second, the low-key and surprise-free approach to the conduct of our bilateral relations. The first one is even more critical than the second one. That is to say, without the 1992 consensus, I doubt the current status quo can be maintained. I hope this invaluable model will continue well into the future, even after I step down as President of the Republic of China. Today's program will now continue with a two-way video conference, so please do submit your questions. I trust that today's program will be a great success. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, President Ma, for your profound and thoughtful comments. We're now going to go into the Q&A session, starting off with Tom Finger. Tom?
President Ma, thank you very much for agreeing to this televised exchange for the points that you made in your speech. I will echo what Dr. Perry said, many, many excellent points. I would like to pick up on one of the points in the latter part of your address, namely your proposal last week for a peace initiative in the South China Sea. And I certainly think this is a very sensible approach. And I have two questions about it, if you could elaborate. The first is, in the spirit of close communication and no surprises, was your proposal shared with Beijing and with the other claimant states before you made it? Did they help in formulating it? And secondly, how will you work to advance this proposal now that you have put it out there for others to react to? How will you use the influence that you have, the example that is set in the East China Sea, to persuade others to sign on to your proposal?
Mm-hmm. Well, these are very good questions. First of all, before we propose the South China Sea Peace Initiative, obviously we will let our friends know in advance what we will be doing. This is a very important step, hoping that we will achieve the similar results as we did in the East China Sea Peace Initiative. Well, you raise an interesting question. In addition to the broad and general ideas of peace, of lower down the tension and stop the escalation of unilateral action, we also have a roadmap which we'll announce in the near future. As the case in East China Sea Peace Initiative, we certainly have a, as I said, broad and general plans. But within a month, we came up with a roadmap. We hope we will have three sets of bilateral talks between Japan, mainland China and Taiwan and Japan. If we can come up with concrete results after the three sets of bilateral talks, then we may be able to enter into a one set trilateral negotiations. So far, mainland China and Japan already have fishery agreements and agreements on the exploration of hydrocarbon resources. We don't have any agreement with mainland China now, but we did have one, as I mentioned in my address, in 2013. We concluded a Taiwan-Japan fisheries agreement, which effectively dealt with the fishery dispute in the last 40 years. So the agreement is working quite well because we set up a permanent commission in order to oversee the operation of the agreement. So every time we have a problem, if we have an incident, we take that to the commission and usually consult over there. So I think we have established a feasible, workable solution in dealing with a regional dispute. Your question is, can I apply this to South China Sea? I have to admit, South China Sea situation is much more complicated. There are more claims, and the sea area is much larger. And so we need to be more patient. But it is quite clear that the competition of territorial claims would lead nowhere. The idea is that while national sovereignty cannot be divided or compromised, but natural resources can be shared. This is probably the only way to downsize the problem and trying to find out the solution. So this is something, actually, we tried for a little bit with the Philippines in the last couple of years. We also had a series of fishery disputes with the Philippines, which is very much like what we had with Japan. Particularly 2 years ago, one of our fishermen was shot dead, and his ship seriously damaged as a result of the charge that they are operating in the Filipino exclusive economic zone. But actually, that zone is also claimed by us. So it's an overlapping AEC. Whatever, the fisherman was killed, so we launched protests against the Filipinos, demanding an apology, compensation for the victim's family, and prosecuting the Coast Guard persons for shooting with automatic weapons, and concluding agreements with Taiwan on fishery things. Well, in the last 2 years, we have actually accomplished almost everything. They apologize, they compensate the family of the victim, and they indicted the person, the perpetrators, eight of them, for homicide. And we have negotiated not a fishery agreement, but agreement on the mode of enforcement. And there are three key components. First of all, no force is used. whatever. Secondly, prior notification before enforcement. And number three, if in case of arrest or detention, prompt release should be guaranteed. Actually, in the last 2 years, we did have several incidents, but all this consensus applied. So we have been able to solve those disputes no later than a week, in some cases only a few hours. In case of violation of a law, the fisherman may be fined, but after they pay the fine and they're released. So we try to reduce the number of the disputes, and we try to shorten the distance that it would take, the time it would take to resolve this dispute. So that's what we mean. That we try to settle in disputes with peaceful means. And we hope similar arrangement could be also made to other parts of South China Sea. But as I said, South China Sea is much bigger and more complicated. What else can you expect? If we don't do this, we certainly will see there's a serious situation coming up in the future. Thank you.
Thank you, President Ma. Next question from Dr. Chen.
Thank you, Professor. Thank you, Mr. President, for your time. Thank you for appearing with us by video at Stanford. We welcome you to Stanford, and thank you for your eloquent and insightful remarks. I want to ask you a question about a topic that is of mutual interest to our two societies, and that's the topic of trade. One of the things that the United States and the Republic of China share is a desire for a safer and more prosperous world. Key to creating a more prosperous world is a regime of trade liberalization. Here in the United States, we've been engaged in a huge discussion and debate over something which you are very familiar with, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, or TPP. This has been a priority for your administration. It's been a priority for the Republic of China over the last several years, and I hope will be a priority for years to come. So what I'd like to know from you, Mr. President, is what you intend to do in your last months in office to advance the ball as Taiwan seeks participation in the Trans-Pacific Partnership, and how you intend to ensure that future administrations will also carry the banner of the value of trade liberalization, not just for the Republic of China, but for societies in the region as well.
Well, thank you for that very good question. Actually, ever since last year, we have lined up all the departments in our government to prepare for our participation in TPP. TPP now involves 12 countries, all our trading partners. Together, the trade accounts to 35% of our total bilateral trade. That means $200 billion a year. So this is vitally important to us, because our GDP growth, about 70%, depends on our bilateral trade. We understand it's difficult to join because none of the 12 potential members of TPP are our diplomatic allies. We don't have diplomatic relations with them. That makes our participation difficult. But on the other hand, trade knows no boundaries. And so we continue to express our strong interest to do that. Thanks to the American government, which has many times expressed their appreciation of our interest in joining the TPP. And that is why we watch attentively what happened in your Congress. We are very happy that the TPP actually passed Senate and now it's in the House. We hope that also passed, so we have a chance to join the multilateral negotiations of the TPP. Certainly, we have to prepare ourselves for that. We have to further liberalize our trade and deregulate our regulation. As I said, ever since the early, this January last year, we have already lined up a different department of the government, and we've also called back our representatives abroad for a consultation to make sure that we understand the need of the potential partners of TPP. We have been advised by the U.S. government that we could use the U.S.-Korea FTA as a model for our participation in TPP. So we are doing that. As you know, as is the case in many countries, the process of liberalization is no easy job. So we also appropriate a large sum of money to cope with that situation for consultations, for other financial help to the companies which may incur damages or other losses as a result of further liberalization. But for us, for the Republic of China, we have no choice. Actually, as I said, we depend so much on foreign trade, and we have to catch up with our trading partners and competitors. Take Korea, for example. Yesterday, they finally inked the FTA with mainland China, which will take effect probably later this year. As of now, in Taiwan, only 10% of the goods we export are covered by FTA type of agreement. In the case of Korea, it's more than 35. And after their deal with mainland China, I'm sure it will go up more than 40%. So we are actually competing with our major competitors, not at an equal footing. We need a more, not only stable, but also fair environment to facilitate our exports, which is our lifeline. So I think you raised a very good question. But in the last 2 years or so, we do have some domestic problems. For instance, we have signed a trade in services agreement with mainland China 2 years ago. But the agreement is still in our legislative yuan, our national parliament, waiting for approval. After 20 rounds of public hearing, we still see no progress. And this is certainly a message our trading partners probably do not like to see, because they hope once an agreement is negotiated and completed, they could receive a proper arrangement in their national parliament in order for that agreement to become a reality. So this is something we hope we can conquer in the near future in my last year in office. But I also want to say that for our relations with the United States, our joining the TPP is a vital step to promote and to reinvigorate the trade and investment relations between our two countries. Thank you.
Thank you, President. Let me now turn to General Archenberry.
Good morning, Mr. President. I feel very privileged to be able to participate in this conversation with you. During your remarks, Mr. President, you had noted that President Eisenhower, in 1958, during the Taiwan Strait crisis, dispatches the U.S. Navy to help resupply Matsu and Jinmen. And that reminded me, in 1971, as a West Point cadet, I went to Kaohsiung and studied at the Nationalist Military Academy, but we also had an opportunity with the Taiwan Air Force to fly us to Jinmen. And Mr. President, there were 100,000 troops on that island. It was a fortress. Now, in 40 years later, in 2011, your national security advisor, Minister Gao at that time, arranged for me to go to Jinmen again. And at that time, there weren't so many troops. In fact, I think there were more mainland tourists on the island than there were local population. I say
right.
All of that because of the dramatic changes that have occurred over the history of the Republic of China and Taiwan with your national security situation. But still, it's challenging and it's very complex. I know that you as president and commander-in-chief have looked very carefully at your strategy. You've looked at the composition of your force. You've looked at the possibility of moving to a volunteer force. I'd be very interested, Mr. President, in what your vision is for your armed forces in the future and for your defense strategy.
Well, ever since we improved our relation with the mainland, a similar question always come up. How do we deal with our defense? As you know, Ever since about 2005, the military balance across Taiwan Strait has been toward the mainland China because they increased their military budget almost 20% every year. So there's no way we could engage the mainland in an arms race. So we have to rethink about our defense strategy in order to deter the potential adversary from attacking Taiwan. I have developed an idea of a three-line defense. The first line of defense is the institutionalization of rapprochement with mainland China. As you know, before I took office, there were no commercial flights between Taiwan and mainland. Now, it's 120 flights a day. In other words, together it's only 240 a day. And on the other hand, there's more, as you observe, more tourists of mainland in Cayman than soldiers. So this is a reality. This is a status quo. And neither side want to unilateral change, particularly with non-peaceful means. So we try to build a super stable framework so that none of us want to do that in the future. That is a unilateral change. The second line of defense is to make Taiwan an asset instead of a liability to the international community. So we try our best to play the role of a responsible stakeholder, a peacemaker, and a provider of international humanitarian aid. As you can see, we try very hard to do that. Not only in mainland China's earthquake, in Japan's tsunami or nuclear incident, but also in the earthquake in Haiti and the Ebola in West Africa. We try our best to make sure that as long as we can afford it, we try to help other countries. So we will continue to play that role. And number three is our military forces. Beginning 3 years ago, we started an ambitious program to make our armed forces a voluntary one. Please watch the way I use voluntary, not all voluntary. What does that mean? Well, all voluntary means that there's no conscription at all. We have not gotten rid of conscription for every male, young man. He still has to serve 4 months of military training in armed forces, just to prepare him as a soldier. And then he could retire in the reserve. For one thing, this is a requirement of our constitution. If we want to change that, we have to change our constitution first. But that has also an advantage that to make every family that has a male member has something to do with the military. So military will have a broader contact with society. And on the other hand, we try to downsize our armed forces to make it better, more in quality. Initially, some people feared that we might have difficulties to recruit the necessary number of soldiers we need. But last year, it was interesting to note that we asked for 10,500, but there were 3,000 come to 30,000 come to report, and that enabled us to pick and choose 15,000. So we are getting more confident on our ability to recruit the needed soldiers to make a voluntary forces. On the other hand, we still need the weaponry from outside. So we are very grateful to the United States for defensive weapons under the Taiwan Relations Act. The most urgent need at the moment is lethal engine subs. And that we have been waiting for almost 13 years. And so we have decided a couple of years ago to take a two-pronged approach to to this question. First of all, we want to do it ourselves with the help from outside. In case we are unable to acquire from a foreign country, so it will take us longer, but at least we'll be able to manufacture one in the future. Certainly, we still need advanced weaponry in order to implement a policy of viable deterrence. So that still requires very close cooperation with the United States. So far, I'm quite satisfied that in the last 7 years, the security cooperation with the United States has never been better before. This is a very important, not only because we will become a very important part of the rebalancing to Asia strategy of the United States, but also our existence, our efforts to play the role of regional peacemaker actually contribute to the peace and stability in this part of the world. So we will work hand in hand with the United States to become an important foundation of peace and prosperity in this part of the world. That's our grand strategy. Thank you.
Tom, do you have a follow-on question?
Well, I'd like to return the question to the topic of the status quo. You explained what it means in part. I invite you to elaborate, and the question is prompted by experience that I had in commentary during what was called the normalization of U.S.-China relations, where it was argued by many that if the relationship wasn't moving forward, it was automatically sliding back. And arguably, because of the extent of the changes that have occurred in the cross-strait relationship, mm-hmm. the status quo is dynamic. It's not static. It's not something that can be frozen for a while. But it needs to continue to move forward. And I wonder if you would comment on that, if you think appropriate.
Well, actually, the word status quo was first used in the context of cross-strait relations 7 years ago when I took office. In my inaugural address, I put it very bluntly that we will promote the policy of no unification, no independence, and no use of force under the framework of the Republic of China Constitution, and promote cross-strait relations on the One China respective interpretation formula, which is something we call 92 consensus. All these elements constitute the status quo on which we built today's cross-strait relation. It is very different from the status quo of 7 years ago. We have actually overhauled the cross-strait relation to a point that the people on both sides of Taiwan Strait actually feel the need to preserve the status quo. So in all the opinion polls we have conducted so far in the last 7 years, more than 80% of the people support the status quo between Taiwan and the mainland. And that is why even the presidential candidate of the opposition party also says she wants to support status quo. This is an interesting development because usually opposition leaders will change the status quo. But whatever, we think it's very important to have that consensus. And the status quo, no unification, no independence, and no use of force, means that we will not, as I said 7 years ago, to engage the mainland in unification talks. And what I mean by no unification. No independence, we will not support the policy of independence in Taiwan, because there's no such need. And, I was asked 5 years ago by Christina Avanport of CNN, why didn't we declare independence? I told her, Christina, have you ever heard any country in the world that declared independence twice? Because obviously there's no such need. And on the other hand, it's also more important that we should not allow the use of force in settling the dispute between Taiwan and mainland China. So if we can keep these three elements, I think we will have status quo. But I don't know whether everyone is confident that in the future the leaders of Taiwan will do that. Another thing is what I said, the 92 consensus, which is the consensus the two sides of Taiwan is very rich back in 1992. It was actually proposed by Taiwan under the former president, Li Denghui, when he actually made that decision in a plenary session of the National Unification Council. The mainland accepted that, when China respected unification. But in the last 7 years, I have also made it very clear, when we interpret one China, that one China to us is Republic of China. And we are determined not to promote the policy of two Chinas, the policy of one China, one Taiwan, and a policy of Taiwan independence. So these assurances have made a very important cornerstone of the status quo. So we welcome anyone in Taiwan to support the status quo. But the status quo is the status quo now, not 7 years ago. If that can be done, I'm sure the peace and stability in the Taiwan Strait will be maintained. Thank you.
President Ma, we're now going to turn to questions from the audience. The first one is as follows. What steps is your government taking to decrease economic inequality, and what still needs to be done?
Okay, this is a very, very good question for a country like Taiwan, which attaches a lot of importance to the equitable distribution of wealth. As you know, our founding father, Dr. Sun Yat-sen, already advocated policy of equitable distribution of wealth. He has the three principles of people, and the third one, Min Shen Zhu Yi, is exactly that. So in the last 30 years, we have tried every possible way to make the distribution of income and wealth more equitable than before. As of now, in terms of income distribution in Taiwan, if we use the so-called Oshima Index, which use the top 20% families and bottom 20% family, and see the difference. During the financial tsunami, the difference is about 6.34 times. And the last year, the figure went down to 6.08. We're talking about family disposable income. But if we use the personal income of individuals of that family, then it's 4.08 times. Of course, this may not completely show the whole picture, so we certainly still have a lot of room to improve. But compared to other countries in the region, I think we actually, in this area, we actually have done better than Singapore, Hong Kong, and South Korea, the other three Asian directors. And we are going to do more through, first of all, the change of our tax system to let the rich sort of have more contribution in this regard. Another one is we will increase our social welfare, because they are a number of people in society who simply do not have any income. So the government has helped them. In the last 7 years, my administration has changed the social welfare picture to a very significant extent. For instance, for those under the poverty line, used to be 260,000 people. But now we have lowered the standard and let more have the subsidies from the government. The number now is 700,000. So our social welfare expenditure has become number one compared to other subjects the government are using. So this is a national policy to continue to shorten the distance between the rich and the poor. Well, we have made some progress, but certainly we have to do more. And I think the method will continue to be, first of all, the change of the tax structure and then social welfare. So we are proposing a combined tax of land and housing in the near future. We hope if we can get that passed, it certainly will contribute more to the equitable distribution of wealth in Taiwan. This is a question that will be with us for a long time, but we will gradually change the current difference and hope eventually we will be more equitable. Thank you.
Another question from the audience. If mainland China becomes more democratic, do you think Taiwanese people would be more likely to use cross-strait relations more quantitatively or even support unification?
It's a very good question. Very hypothetical. First of all, we certainly hope that China could be more democratic. We're not trying to import and impose the Western value on mainland China. If we look at Chinese history, even in the time of spring and order period, some of the rulers are advised to tolerate dissent. Let me repeat, to tolerate dissent. And this is not a Western tradition. In Chinese, we call it 子产不悔相教. There was a ruler who heed to his advisor's suggestion that let a forum open for the countrymen to criticize the government. This is something of a tradition for over 2,000 years. So that's one thing. If we can do that, and if a man in China could do that, I'm sure the psychological distance between mainland China and Taiwan will be greatly shortened. I cannot promise that people then will support unification, but at least the people on both sides of Taiwan Strait can then think on an equal basis. This is actually what I have said every time we see something that mainland China may do. I understand their developmental strategy is different from ours. They spend most of their energy on the economic side, and they have already created remarkable results after 30 years of a very fast development. But the people of mainland China, they are more and more middle class emerging. They are more and more interested in participating in the decision of public affairs. So this is something that is also inevitable and irreversible. That is why every time I have a chance, I will advise the man as a friend, as someone who has experienced the democratization process in Taiwan, that if mainland China could do this, obviously there will be more people from Taiwan. They want to really deal with the mainland. So this is a first step. For a further integration between Taiwan and the mainland. Certainly, we hope that will be a reality in the future.
President Ma, speaking for everyone in this room and for the other rooms tuned into this program, I want to thank you for this wonderful, inspiring session you've given us. And I'd also like to give you the opportunity to make some closing remarks.
Okay. Well, ladies and gentlemen, before we conclude today's video conference, I'd like to extend my sincere thanks again to Secretary Perry, to Professor Diamond, to Professor Dr. Finger, to Ambassador Eikenberry, to Dr. Chen, and to the Stanford University Center on Democracy, Development, and the Rule of Law, and to all the members in the audience. I deeply appreciate your efforts in organizing this important conference on the 70th anniversary of the Republic of China's victory in the resistance war against Japan. as well as your generosity in sharing with me your views and prospects for the future of East Asia. I would additionally like to commend your audience and distinguished guests for their enthusiastic participation, insightful views, and challenging questions. It has been an honor to exchange views with such distinguished participants. Last but not least, let us salute all those who endured, suffered, and sacrificed to achieve peace and victory 70 years ago, and forge a friendship that endures to this day. Thank you very, very much.
Take this opportunity, first of all, to thank the President of the Republic of China, Taiwan, one last time, President Ma Ying-jeou, for those eloquent and very spirited remarks. And Mr. President, I don't know how you remember all those facts and figures, but you'd be a very successful politician in the United States. And I want to thank our panelists, former Secretary of Defense, and beloved professor at Stanford, Bill Perry, Professor Tom Finger, Ambassador Carl Eikenberry, and Dr. Lan He Chen. Thank you all so much. One last thing, we've received many, many questions, Mr. President, many more than we could distill and pose to you here. With your permission and with the cooperation of Ambassador Chen, and if anyone else has them, we will gather them all up and convey them to you, at least so you know what people were asking you here. Thank you all so much.
Larry? Larry?
Yes.
Please give us all the questions you have received. We will try to answer that one by one.
Okay.
Not today, though.
We will do that, I promise. Thank you so much, Mr. President. Thank you, panelists, and thank you, audience. So if anyone else has a question that you'd like to have to